Hi, everybody. This is Polly Myers at Break Free from Anxiety. Today is our Tuesday evening anxiety Q&A call. It's the last call for the year, 2015. And the next time you hear us, it will be 2016. And Josh is here, so why don't you say hello, Josh?
Hello, everyone.
Everybody have a happy holiday. This is big times coming up. I'm going to go visit Josh. I'll be flying out on Tuesday and stay with him. So things that I couldn't do before. So actually I'm doing a lot of things I wouldn't have done before. Okay, Josh, we'll just jump right into this. I had some people that said they really needed to talk to us. I don't see them on the line yet or any hands up. So if you would like to ask a question, have some input, just hit *2 on your keypad on your telephone, and you can, and we'll see this little hand rise up and we'll be able to get to you as soon as we can. Okay. I've had anxiety issues for a long time and have never really done much about it. I've just been sucking it up and trying to deal with it. Well, that's not working this time. My husband was laid off from his full-time job yesterday, Wednesday. Everybody that's jumping on right now, just to remind you, hit *2 if you have a question or a comment. Okay, let me see. So we're going to go. Okay, so her husband was laid off yesterday from his full-time job. I have been a stay-at-home mom since April due to a fall at work. He's been supporting us while I make and sell jewelry and other accessories. This is happening so close to Christmas. I can't breathe. I can't sleep. I'm nervous all the time. Our daughter came to us yesterday with a note that said, "I love you both very much. I hope this helps." And all of her piggy bank change. We are both now looking for work and applying to everything. I don't know how I'm going to suck it up this time. Needing some prayers or whatever. Any tips on not freaking out?
Yeah, so this is a pretty common trap we get into. There's a couple things. You know, many of us have struggled with anxiety many times before we finally reach out for help. And you know, anxiety often, you know, we are able to get through it somehow. Sometimes it's weeks, sometimes it's months, sometimes it's years. And if we don't do a lot, oddly enough, we actually seem to get through. But what I'm always trying to teach people is to be proactive and learn skills that you can keep for a lifetime that, you know, will help you when life gets hard again. I am no different than anybody who writes in. Other than I have a bunch of different pieces of the puzzle, sort of. I have a bunch of information, and believe me, I put it to work. And I'm very aware that if I quit, I would possibly go back to where I was. And in a way, that could be viewed as frightening, but in a way, it could be viewed as really encouraging that the skill set that I have now, it doesn't go away. It works every time. Although I must admit that when anxiety or depression is cranking, you begin to doubt. You're like, is it going to work this time? Is the same stuff going to work this time? Somehow those doubts always creep in. And for me, all I can say is it has so far. I worked myself out of a pretty difficult time and have stayed out for a long time. And I've had plenty of opportunities to fall back. And for all of us, life will throw big-time curveballs. And, you know, I can relate to this person's sense of helplessness, this person's sense of probably anger, impotence kind of, like a lack of power. You know, to have your own child come and offer money out of a piggy bank, I mean, that's hard. And there's a lot of emotions that should come out of a situation like that. The difference is, for those of us who struggle with anxiety, we kind of push back against a lot of those feelings. We really are kind of intimidated by the strength of emotion that can come from difficult times. And then day by day, just that constant push back, it's like a resistance to experiencing sadness, anger, loss, pain, frustration, all these things. We've been taught early on with our anxiety that if we let our emotions go, we'll have a panic attack. We'll become incapacitated. And oddly enough, this is much more like a Chinese finger trap, where the harder you pull against it, the worse it grips down on you. And the most straightforward thing to do is just keep pulling harder and harder and harder. And unfortunately, with anxiety, it takes all that power and tends to kind of twist it right back on you. Okay, all that being said, there's a bunch of things that I love teaching that gets people out of this place. You know, it's important to mention that working with the Breakthrough Program has helped me get a huge piece of the puzzle and understand that. And I think this person would verify that, but as you watched this happen, it wasn't overnight. It wasn't as though there was no warning of any kind and all of a sudden we fell into this hole. We find that we experience some stress, some anxiety, and unfortunately we're past a certain tipping point where it gets kind of worse and worse with each day. And with the Breakthrough Program, we're able to put back those critical nutrients that are being depleted just by going through day after day of anxiety. You know, I have gone down this road, and it's pretty vicious. When you're unable to put that stuff back, it just eventually becomes, for me, a pretty all-day, everyday kind of thing. There weren't, for me, a lot of panic attacks in that world, not really out of the norm, but the generalized anxiety was pretty tough. And I don't know if I've talked about it much on the calls, but I'm what I describe as medication neutral. That's just one piece to the puzzle, which I did use. But a huge piece of the puzzle that really allowed me to fully get my life back was the Breakthrough Program. There's something critical about that. I mean, I still take some of those nutrients every single day to feel well. And when I feel myself getting worn out, sensitive, vulnerable, there's a lot of words I could use. I kind of up some things doses-wise in the Breakthrough world, not in, importantly to note, in the medication world. And I'm able to get back on track. In the medication world, I guess I can proudly say I am just about done with getting off one of the tougher to get off medication. I've dedicated about a year to this effort now. And so those of you who do take medication and want to get off of it, I want to let you know that's totally possible. I was taking one of the ones that is the most addictive, the most difficult to get off of. And I'm just about done. And it's been manageable. I don't believe without the Breakthrough Program it would have been manageable. And the big takeaway is I like my life. I like where it is right now. A question like this, you know, just makes me want to launch into all the things I know. I know I can't do that, though, in the confines of this call, but I will say that there's a bunch of tools that we can use, the Breakthrough Program being a big one. And I was trying to kind of get at it through the answer, which is to allow yourself to feel. There's a tendency to learn to want to push back on every big emotion, and that's really not the right way to respond. We should let some of that stuff
in. I want to jump in here a little bit.
Sure.
Because in my situation, it was similar in that I did all the home stuff. I got myself into a comfort zone, and she's now she has this crisis that she has to do something. Well, my crisis was that my husband said, I've had it, you know, leave. You know, go home, go stay with your parents and little house they had, pack up the kids, go home. And, of course, at first I was just freaking out, panicking, and it was terrible. But then I, believe it or not, started working a little bit on my terms, and I found when I made money, it gave me power. It was really helpful for my own personal self to feel like I could make money and I could take care of myself. It balanced out the relationship a lot more when I suddenly realized that I could do that. Actually, it turned out I made good money. Surprisingly, I've told you before, I sold real estate because my father was in real estate. Nothing was handed to me, believe me, but I was very, very good at it. I was very sensitive, used my sensitivities to tune into exactly what people wanted, and I knew what to show them, and I never, ever took anybody in my car. I had every excuse in the world, but I would meet them at this house, or they would follow me or whatever, and I knew that it was exactly what they wanted. Anyway, this was before that we discovered the Breakthrough Program, and I just have to say, it did not get rid of everything by any means. But when you have to make your own money, and you do, it gives you this sense of power, and I don't know, it's probably more the psychological part that you deal with, Joshua, rather than we talk. Break free is the physical part, the absolute physical part that's not your fault, that's totally, you can't help it, that kind of thing. But taking charge of your life is something you can do. And going out and doing something where you feel like you're contributing is really, really important. And by the way, she must be raising a great daughter for her to come and hand her the money from her piggy bank. I think that's really wonderful. That child must be not spoiled, very sensitive herself and tuned into her parents' needs. And I just want to tell her what a wonderful parent she most likely is, because a lot of kids would be saying, what do you mean? I don't get this and I don't get that. And the fact that she came up and offered what she had, I think that's wonderful. So I know, Josh, this person is somebody that you would need to work out. Being in crisis, though, sometimes being desperate in crisis is when you make the decisions. This time is it. This is it. I've had it. I'm sick of it. It's, you know, when you're on the floor in the bathroom or, you know, you just can't handle anymore is when you make that decision to make a change. And I just see that happen. People just go on and on and on, and they don't make the commitment. And then something like this happens, and that's what it takes. And they just say, I've got to do it. I don't have any choice. Do you have anything else to add before we go to the next one?
Yeah, all the time when I start this process with people, you know, I have both. I have clients that kind of have this sense of desperation that they have to keep the money coming in. They are the breadwinner. There's something very critical about them staying working. And there's another group that doesn't have that. They're the spouse that doesn't have to work. And generally speaking, as frightening as it is, kind of have to keep going to work, those people tend to do better over time. Their challenge is to keep at it, right? But they tend to recover more quickly. When they make changes, they tend to settle kind of in quicker. They're forced to keep working. They can't take a break. You know, every Monday rolls around and they've got to keep going. The people who don't have that, different challenges, right? They've got all the time in the world to work on the stuff that we practice.
All the time to hide. Josh, do you see there's a hand that's popped
up? I do.
Out?
I do.
You can finish what you were thinking.
Yeah, so it's different challenges. The people who have that, you know, need to go to work, it's hard, but often they tend to do better. Those of us who don't have that, it's a different kind of discipline. We have to do the work every day, even though our anxiety and depression is telling us to sit still, don't go, don't do it, don't try. So we have to do what we want to do least. So I see Estonia with your hand up. Hi, what can we answer for you?
Hi, Josh. I have a question. I have a 12-year-old son. He's just started playing basketball. He's in the team, his school team, and he's really good at it. But whenever he gets and starts playing sports, you know, like in the games, he freezes up because he's surrounded by people, and he gets really upset. He goes, Mom, I'm really good at, you know, like getting the ball in the hoop, but why am I missing? I get so nervous in front of people. Everybody's staring at me. So I told him, you know, it's you have a little anxiety, and then my husband got upset at me. He goes, he does not have anxiety. My son is okay. Because he never has dealt with it in the past, and I have. So I'm like, well, we need to let him know that it's okay that he has anxiety, and we have to just work with him. So it was like a little dispute. So what do you think I should do? Should I talk to him about anxiety or ignore it?
Well, first of all, does anxiety show up anywhere else in your family, or is he the only one?
Well, me, I have anxiety.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, each parent has something to bring here. What I tend to say, first of all, is to just look at your son. And you've worded it beautifully. I see this all the time. There's a bunch of things that the anxious kid does easily that other kids struggle with. In this case, you brought up basketball. Sometimes it's academic. Sometimes it's all of the above. But all the stuff that normal kids struggle with, your kid does already. Great. So maybe we don't need to put much emphasis on that for now, but his struggle is anxiety. I don't mind the word being used. at all. I have a 10-year-old son who struggles with anxiety. Sports, I think, overall are a positive thing. But remember, just like how you struggle, there's going to be a sense of catastrophe. There's going to be a what if. And it'd be interesting to kind of figure out what that is. You don't want to model a lot of anxious behavior. It's kind of your time to shine as far as maybe, you know, continuing to do stuff that you find challenging and model for him that you can be anxious and still be successful and active in doing things. That's something I'm constantly trying to model. If I'm at a point where my anxiety is maybe telling me maybe don't do something, maybe do something, I tend to try to do it because I want to model that, right? I don't want to show my son a lot about, you know, how to be anxious and let your life get restricted. In my own son's case, I did introduce him to the Break Free Program stuff, and I showed him that, look, this is just chemistry. Yes, your brain's going to do all these things. You're not alone. You and this famous sports star, of which there's a ton, by the way, this famous actress, this famous singer, this famous, you can just go down the list of these incredibly successful people who struggled with what he struggled with and maybe turn it from a negative to a positive, that you're in great company. You know, people who struggle with this, it's totally normal. We tend to be smarter. We tend to be great at what we do. So there's a lot to do here, but I'd keep him in sports. I try to model good behavior, and yeah, I would talk about it kind of in a, you don't want to like give him like you don't want to show him a bunch of examples of how you're afraid, like teach him how to be anxious, but say, oh, I struggle with that sometimes, but as best you can, be a good role model of how to succeed with that. If I might ask, how are you doing with your anxiety?
Well, I still struggle, especially driving.
Sure.
The driving is the worst for me. I know, like, for Christmas, I'm going to New York, and I have to drive. So I'm just thinking about it gives me anxiety.
Sure.
But I'm still going to go ahead and drive it. Like, I'm not going to let that stop me. But
good.
I still struggle. So, I mean, I do take vitamins, like the fish oil, B12 shots, that I give that to my kids, too. Because I don't want them to go through why, you know, what I've gone through 3 years ago when my anxiety was really bad. I just couldn't even leave the house.
Okay.
So I'm trying to prevent that happening to my kids.
So there's a lot that you've learned that you can share about being courageous in the simple day-to-day things.
Exactly.
Have you ever used medication?
I did use Lexapro for like 6 months, mm-hmm. and it helped a lot, but I just didn't want to rely on it. I wanted to help me through the hump. And once
sure.
I got better, I said, okay, I'm going to get off medication and let me just work, you know, through it myself. And it did. I went down a little, and I could feel a difference while I was taking medication and now. I was
okay.
much better at taking medication, but I still feel like I could do it on my own, and I will, and I try to put my mind, like, I'm gonna fight it, and I'm going to get where I want to get. To the point where I want to get. And it's not easy. I know it's going to take me a while. It's going to take me a couple of years or maybe, you know, a year or two. But that's okay. But it's a struggle. And, you know, he had no idea what anxiety was. He's like, Mommy, what is anxiety?
Right.
He's, you know, well, I say, well, you know, if you get a little nervous sometimes or fear, which I explained to him a little bit. Because I never wanted to show my kids that I was struggling through anxiety. But now I say, you know, well, Mommy's a little anxious sometimes. That's okay, though, you know. I don't want it to be where they don't know what anxiety is.
Right.
Do you have problem with your husband? There's a lot of, I don't know what culture you're from, but even cultures and men in particular are very hard on letting anybody admit they have anxiety, specifically if it's a male child. So I don't think you've been through the Break Free program. I don't recognize working with you. And did you download the little booklet we have on the Facebook page or our website that your husband can read?
I have, and I even took him to therapy when I was seeing a therapist a couple of years ago. And
no, I meant the little book that we have,
yes.
Is Three Tricky Truths.
Yeah, I have. I actually, I've read it
has
myself.
Has your husband read it?
No,
read it?
No.
Well, Josh, you can talk more about this because Josh works with a lot of men. It's really interesting. Traditionally, they say that this is mostly women. That is not what Josh has found, and he has, what, 50-50%, Josh, male and female?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Because he approaches it completely differently, and maybe your husband needs to be in on this. Josh, you go ahead and talk about that.
Well, yeah, I'm going to absolutely agree that the two parents need to have an understanding on this and what it's going to generally look like. And this is true for any support person, whether it's your husband to you, whether it's you to your child, your husband to your child, if you're just helping a friend. The idea is the same. We, first of all, learn what's going on. We educate ourselves a little bit so that we know what it is. We have some language to describe it. If you're someone who struggles with anxiety, great. You know, you can have a certain level of dialogue that another person can't. And but if you're working with somebody, if you're the anxious person, working with someone who doesn't understand, please don't ever understand them. Expect them to understand. This is something that you just don't get without experiencing a panic attack. You know, I can communicate all I want to people who've never had this, and I can only get so far. So that being said, what we do as support people, after we have some understanding, hopefully we trust each other, and we develop that trust, meaning between support person and person with anxiety, by saying, look, in the moment, you're completely free. And what I mean by that is if we're working on driving the car, if you need to pull over, turn around, take a break, get a hotel room, go to the bathroom, whatever, we are completely relaxed about that, complete freedom. But as far as the big picture, as far as that we're going to, you know, accomplish what we need to accomplish, whatever that happens to be, we're like a ratchet, you know, that only moves one way and doesn't really go back. And so, you know, if we fall off the horse today, we're going to get back on it tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And we're going to go to as many basketball games as we need to. We're going to take as many trips on the highway as we need to until this is a distant memory. There's really, unfortunately, no magic to kind of getting our life back that way. So, again, kind of like really fluid and flexible and forgiving in the moment. But big picture, yeah, we're always moving one direction. We're going to keep growing and growing and growing. I hope that makes sense. I want to get back a little bit to working with a kid because I'm kind of going through it right now, and I think I have some special insight on that. For me, my big understanding with anxiety was to know that this is just chemistry. It's chemistry that messes with your brain in a really significant way. It's powerful, but it can't hurt you. It can seem like this huge, huge, you know, tidal wave that can sweep you away. But if you'll notice, time and time again, nothing really happens. You know, and I was able to expose my kid early on. His name is Nathan. It was a blast. It was so intimidating when I saw that he was first having anxiety. And I said, well, what have I learned? And he was having anxiety at night. It wasn't every night, but it was some nights. And I said, well, let's look, you know, how did you treat yourself that day? How did you exercise? You know, did you eat right? And he's like, well, I had candy and soda and all this stuff. And I said, well, let's look at that. How about tomorrow we have protein for breakfast, protein for lunch, watch the sweets and see if we feel any better. And lo and behold, he felt great. And so now he knows that, okay, I've got to watch my blood sugar. He's 10 years old. It wasn't that complicated of an idea. But what it taught him was, I can do something about this. How I treat my body affects how my body treats me. And that took some of the fear away. He loved hearing that I struggled. I remember him telling me that. Just to know that, you know, me, who I think he believes is a pretty good human being, has anxiety, has to work on it. I don't view it as this crippling thing. I just say this is something I have to put some time and energy into to live the life I want to live. So we did that. Then I exposed him to the break-free nutrients, and he found he could get a better night's sleep. He could go to bed easier. That's pretty straightforward stuff. A lot of people report that with the break-free program. Mm-hmm. It works. So he is gaining more control. He struggled with going to like a buffet. Like the big buffets with all the flashing lights and all this food, and I know what happened. You know, he overate a little bit, plus there's probably lots of sweets and soda, and he gets, you know, that kind of full, turns into nausea, now a lot of people, and he starts blaming the situation. That's what we do. It's the car. It's the highway. It's the person. It's the restaurant. All the stuff we do, and I never let him accept that. I always said, no, it's not the basketball game. It's not anything. It's you. For good or for bad, it's you. Good news. Bad news, this is in you. This is you. Good news, you can fix this. You can be well anywhere. Doesn't matter what you're doing. On the space shuttle, in an airplane, on a train. I don't care. It's always you. And I made maybe a controversial decision. I showed him medication, a little bit of a benzodiazepine. I said, notice that when you're really struggling, 30 minutes, worst case, you're never going to be farther away. We can teach you how to make it go away in 90 seconds, but you never feel like, it's like handing the life jacket. I said, look, if you feel like you're drowning, you put this on, and in 30 minutes, you won't be drowning anymore, every time, guaranteed. And that was a big relief for him, and we'll see how that goes. That's kind of a more controversial decision, but it hasn't been an issue. He's back eating at buffets. He goes to school. He's a soccer star. My mom's going to come out, and she'll see him play, and I'm looking forward to that. So I wouldn't change the basketball. I would just show him what it is. This is you. This is a thing you're sensitive to. The beautiful thing about sports is we can turn our view inward and get self-conscious and all that stuff. We have endless opportunity to all of a sudden get back in the moment, right? We're exercising. We have goals. And so the goal isn't like to like reinvent the kid. It's just to say, hey, how can we get you just to that point where you're having fun again? And maybe that's lowering the pressure, lowering the expectation, teaching them some tricks about breathing. There's a lot of ways to go. Once he gets that sense of control, being actually out there performing is oddly enough a great place to realize you can kind of flip it and all of a sudden be out and actually outperforming everyone. The same handicap actually becomes an asset. But it takes a while to teach a kid to kind of flip like that. And my son seems to be doing good as far as sports are concerned. And if you hear how I talk about it, it's in a very casual way, that the sports are optional. You know, there's no big deal. If he wants to do something else, that's fine. But when he makes commitments, he does have to stick with it. You know, we make about a one-year-at-a-time commitment. His soccer is at a kind of high level, so we get committed to these programs for a year at a time. And so he has to accept some of that. You know, that's pressure, I suppose. But outside of that, at the end of each year, he knows it's his choice to move on. So I know I tend to do this. I throw a bunch of information out there, and I never know what's going to connect with people. So.
Well, everything makes sense, especially when you said the sugar linked to anxiety, because my son is 12, and I got him tested, and his sugar is a little on the high side for his age.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I know in my family we have diabetes, so
okay.
I've been very careful with his sugar intake and the gluten, and even the dairy, the doctor said.
It's true. I was surprised, by the way. You know, with kids, it can be a real struggle to change their diet. But anxiety is a powerful coach. And if you teach a kid, you treat yourself that way, this is what happens. You want to see change happen quickly? Anxiety is terrible. And so, you know, when I taught my kid, you know, to increase your protein, watch your sugars, stay hydrated, one day he had changed. You know, he's not like 100%, you know, perfect eater all the time. But, boy, he's pretty good. It's a powerful change. So you can take a look at that. That'd be a great place to start. The underlying message there is you can change this. You have control. This is not out of control. It isn't random. It's frightening, but it's not out of control. You know, it's predictable. In a sense, that's what I'm teaching everyone. And every little tool that I'm adding, that's kind of the underlying message. This thing is controllable. Notice how this affects this. And get your life back. Gain some control back.
Yeah, anxiety is not one little thing. It's lots of little things. That's why in the Break Free program, there's just so much we teach people. We try to do it slowly and easily, but there's just a lot of little things that you have to learn, and then you just put them together, and pretty soon you're doing well. Are we ready for another question?
Yeah, thanks for chipping in, Sonia. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
If you have any
buddy.
More questions, you're welcome. Has a question, we'll see it. Just hit star 2 and you can join the conversation.
And also, if your husband has any, because that's a real problem when the men are very macho about this. And, Josh, you talk about redefining what is hard and what is easy with parents.
I do.
Oops.
I do.
Did that hand just go back up again?
Nope. Oh, I haven't lowered the hand. I muted her, but I'll fix this. There we go.
Okay. Wait a minute. There we are.
If you've listened to me before, if you've listened to a lot of these calls, the closest analogy we have to a panic attack is waterboarding, this horrible form of torture where we simulate drowning. If you look at the chemistry underlying what's going on there, it's basically inducing a panic attack in someone who doesn't have a panic attack response. It's inducing it. It's basically simulating drowning, and that panic associated with drowning, we seem to mostly have. Most all of us respond to that. And so it's this weird version of simulating drowning. I don't feel like going into complete detail about how to torture somebody, but it's basically waterboarding.
Or having a panic attack.
Yeah, and so I think people tend to underestimate who don't have a panic attack, how difficult it is, how intense it is. And it's not, if you go symptom by symptom, my heart accelerates, I don't feel like I can breathe, blah, 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 that won't make sense. You know, for my mom and I, it's more about the gastrointestinal stuff, nausea, diarrhea, all that stuff. And people
and
will
the
say,
head
what?
Stuff. And the head, it's the thinking, the catastrophic thinking.
That is what makes a panic attack so special, is the panic attack's effect on our thinking. By itself, I've been sick with the flu before. You know, I've had all these symptoms, and I get by. But it's the catastrophic thinking that unifies everybody, the panicking, catastrophic, black or white, this is real, this is going to kill me, I don't know how many panic attacks I've had, and it's the darndest thing. You know, if I were to have another one, that thought would have to be there. It's kind of by definition that absolute catastrophic thinking shows up.
Well,
for all of us.
The chemistry makes you think that way. I want to mention again, we've had some people join, and I just want to tell you, if you've never done this before, if you have a question, comment, anything you want to say, you hit star and then the number 2 on your keypad on your telephone, and a little hand pops up. We see it, and then we can answer your questions. So what we'll do is, if we have a lot of email questions, so we start on those, and if we see your hand go up, then you'll be the next one. We dropped off some people. I don't know what happened to them.
It's okay.
I recognized someone who said they were coming on, and it's gone. They're gone. So anyway, did you start to say something?
Oh, I just want to let people know that I really appreciate when people jump in. I really enjoy that experience.
Oh, I know. It's really
with
it's
Sonia.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, I'm still concerned that her husband doesn't understand because he's never had a panic attack. How bad can it really be? Well, let me tell you, it's awful. And I had thousands of them, and I just don't know how I survived. Are we ready?
Well, it's important to know that you did. I'm thinking of one individual who I knew for a long time and never had a panic attack, and then one day he did.
Yeah.
And I could immediately see the change in his soul is the best way to describe it. Until you had one, expecting someone else to fully understand is difficult. Although you can teach the support person, whether or not they can fully comprehend it, but it is a really big event, probably unlike anything they've gone through, and here's how to help. If you want to be my support person, this is what it looks like. It's doable. It's doable, and it's really rewarding to have somebody helping you along as you get your life back. So.
There are very understanding support people. They may not.
Generally. And hopefully we pick good people. Not always, but sometimes.
Yeah, some people pick us on purpose because they feel like they can control us and they're insecure in themselves, so they like to have somebody around them. And then some of those marriages dissolve, if that's the kind of relationship that we're talking about. Sometimes children just decide they're not going to be involved with their family anymore when they get a control of their anxiety because they've been beaten down too badly by the family. Let's see. This is interesting. It's another child one. My daughter has extreme anxiety and has needed a lot of medical assistance this year. She goes to a great school who have helped and understand her feelings of social fears and are very encouraging. She reads a lot, and the teachers have asked her to take part in an assembly where literature is the subject, and in a panic she agreed. Now she's upset and worried about talking. Should I get her out of it like she has asked, or should I try and encourage her to do it? The teachers want her to. They think it will help. I'm torn between protecting her and getting her through her fears, which will be difficult. I'm so confused.
Well, you know, I had the habit when I was going through this of kind of, I described it as running into every cave that had a dragon. And I realized that that's not always the best strategy. If you look at my life choices, I am counterphobic, meaning I tend to see a challenge and go running headlong at it, not whether it's wise or not. And I actually don't think that's the best way to go. When it comes to children, I would communicate that this individual event is not life-defining, and I would make sure I absorb that as a parent. This is not make or break. Our well-being, her long-term well-being, is not hinging on this one event. And I think if that kind of got out into the atmosphere in the family, everyone kind of understood that this is not a big deal. Because remember, as a kid gets nervous, it's going to go more black and white. Remember, as all of us get nervous, it's going to go more black and white. We can actually start believing some of those messages, that if I don't succeed here, that's like some symbol that my life maybe will be a failure. And that's just not accurate. So if we can take some of the pressure on off the moment and say, hey, you know, this is no big deal. This is just an opportunity to practice. If you want it, if not, don't worry. Life throws plenty of opportunities to practice at us. And I, you know, it sounds like there's an understanding school here, but the first thing I would do is make sure that they back off a little bit as well. If we're in a medically crisis year, do we need to necessarily add a curveball into it? No. We can be on a path towards success whether or not we throw these additional challenges in. And I tend to not teach people to go looking for them. I think that life tends to put them in our way just fine. Opportunities to practice are endless. So, yeah, take the temperature down a little bit out of this whole thing. And sometimes when that pressure is gone, the child will realize that they want to do this for their own reasons, not for, you know, some kind of anxiety success thing. You know, how many times have I believed that if I could just do this one thing, I would cure my anxiety? Well, that's just not the way to approach this. If it could be solved that way, I have done literally everything that came up in my life. So where I'm at now, I tend to look at my life and go, would I do this thing if I wasn't anxious? Is this something I would do and enjoy? And this is, mind you, coming from the perspective of someone who's living a pretty good life, who isn't in a crisis anymore. When things are challenging, I just simply ask, would I enjoy doing this? Whether I had anxiety or not. And sometimes the answer is no. That, you know, I've just come to learn that I'm not a real fan of cruise ships. I had to try it three times now, I think, four times in my life.
What?
You're
not
ships.
A fan? What?
That even if I never had an ounce of anxiety, that they're just not my thing. And I'm not alone in the world in that.
What is not your own thing? It's a little hard to hear you.
Oh, really? I'm always worried that I'm going to muscle my microphone. Cruise ships.
Oh, cruise ships.
They're not my thing, and I'm not alone in the world, in that belief. But, you know, being me, I had to try, I think, four
times
here.
Now. Same here.
Just be sure. If something is not something I would choose to do without anxiety. However, if it's something I know I would really love to do, and anxiety, I feel like, the only obstacle getting in my way, maybe there's other obstacles, but that's the big obstacle that it makes me want to say no to it, I tend to push through on those. I tend to go find it. But when it comes to this kid's situation, look, what was she, 12 years old? Was the age mentioned? I'm trying to remember the question.
Yeah,
you know, we've got a lot of life ahead of us, and the biggest lesson here would be actually to show us we can back out of situations like this and still grow in our anxiety, that this is not a symbol of, like, a quitter mentality. We have plenty of challenges that are being presented day in and day out. We don't need to add. And I love teaching people to give themselves out. It's actually, for some people, a critical skill to be able to bow out of situations. It feels really weird for those of us who struggle with social anxiety to learn how to say no, to learn how to go right into the party and then say, oh, I'm not feeling well, I'm just going to go home, and watch that the world does not end. Nothing happens. All these catastrophic expectations we have about judgment and all these things. We end up creating this prison. Socially, we create a prison around us that we feel that there's no exit. There's no strategy. There's no safety. There's no safe way out. And so I will often work with people and say, all right, I want you to set up a social situation and then walk right out of it and watch that the world does not end. And so in this case, I actually think it'd be good to back off and show her that, no, this is no big deal. Everyone still loves you. You keep learning and growing as a human being, and we can back out. Even last moment, I don't know why it was so hard for me to realize that I've watched people fall ill and back out of something at the very last minute, and I don't judge them. Or
get angry and walk out the door. Or
all that stuff.
Or just say, I'm not going to do this. I've seen people do that. Another thing for this question is that she doesn't have the tools yet. You know, there's been no explanation to the daughter, I'm guessing.
I'm sure they've tried. If she's going down the medical route, you know, there's some language that's shown up for sure.
Yeah, but I'm not sure. She said medical assistance. It may be that there were other medical issues. I'm not sure.
I don't know.
But when you start working with somebody, you use tools. There's, you know, you teach them tools. Here's what we're going to do. And backing out happens to be one of them. I teach people when they're driving or walk, let's say they can't get to the mailbox. I mean, they go 10 feet and they turn around as soon as they start feeling that. I mean, and then they go 15 feet and then they turn around as soon as they feel it. So this little girl, it's kind of all or nothing, and it's not. And she has to get those tools that she needs to be able to do some of these things. So, you know, you're right. We don't know if she has some of the tools or not, but I'm just guessing that she doesn't have some of the tools that you would teach somebody.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah.
So, yeah, I'll have somebody call me up and go, well, I just started the Break Free program, and I want to go on a bus trip. And for, you know, a week with all these people. And I'm like, no, you know. And it's just like, no, I don't want you to dig your, what are they called, tracks in your brain deeper yet. We want to start these things slowly, not just jump off the cliff immediately. So.
Yeah, there's a tendency to believe we have to do this big thing. You know, anxiety feels like a big thing, and we feel like we need to combat it with a big thing, whether that's a big chance we take in life, a big risk, a big obstacle. I did plenty of that. Whether we believe that's one big medication, and it's just not how it works. We pick up a bunch of tools. Often the first steps we make are small, but they're the hardest, where we just learn to do these little things to begin to claw back a little bit of our life. And what's odd is when we struggle with those first little goals, things that we've given up long ago, and we make these first strides, maybe it's going to the mailbox, maybe it's taking that first car ride back to the grocery store, that you will tend to say, oh, this is so difficult, I will never become someone who flies on an airplane or goes on a cruise ship or, you know, does the flies to Europe and has an actually enjoyable vacation in Europe. But I promise you that it actually doesn't work that way. That the hard part is right up front. Once we learn how to manage our anxiety, it doesn't really matter. You know, anxiety hits instantly and can go away in 90 seconds. And so whether you're 60 feet away from your house or whether you're 6,000 miles away, and really in the end, it doesn't matter. It's being able to stop and manage right where you're at. But we can get very discouraged by thinking that we need to accomplish these big things, and that's the only way to find wellness, and that's really not how it works.
Okay. I'm ready for the next one.
Great.
I've had bad thoughts before, but they just started up again. My psychologist has said to ignore them, like if it's an email, you don't have to open it. Before I was able to get it under control after months and months of feeling anxious. Now I have a boyfriend, and I feel like I have to tell him about every single thought. If I don't, I feel really anxious and guilty. He knows I have them and says thoughts are thoughts as long as you don't act on them. But the anxiety and guilt won't stop. want some strategies I can use. I'm really at my wit's end. Any help or suggestions would be helpful.
So that's something that comes up a lot. Psychology has struggled with how to explain this to people. I feel pretty comfortable talking about these. I've certainly had them, and most of the people I know who struggled with, you know, long generalized anxiety gets that. So the first step is just acknowledging that this is really common. Everyone gets these. There's at least a billion people on the planet who struggle with anxiety like you do. One out of seven point whatever we're at. That's a pretty low estimate, actually, as far as how many people. So you're not alone in this. And our brain just hates to have unanswered questions. And if you think about it, we all, those of us who struggle with generalized anxiety, ask the why question, what, 1,000 times a day? Thousands of times a day? And I'm not exaggerating. And our brain hates to sit there and not have an answer to a question. So what it does is it hunts around until it kind of creates these little mini movies that are some activity that I, you know, would do. It's kind of like a little five-second clip that you can kind of see it. You can kind of viscerally feel it. So I'll just give a classic example. Women with children tend to gravitate towards the thing they would be most horrified by. That's true of all of us. And for, you know, women with children, it's typically harming their children, throwing them out the window, lighting them on fire. I'm sorry to bring this up, but it's that horrible. And please know that that's the norm. And the odd thing our brain does is it says, oh, look at that. That thought matches this intense anxiety. So, aha, I think I've solved your puzzle. You want to know why? Because you're about to do something like this. Because if you were about to do something like this, now your anxiety makes perfect sense. And as odd as that is, our brain would prefer to feel like it understands the answer, even if it's absolutely the wrong answer, than just sit in that perpetual state of not knowing. And that's just a function of our brain. We just need to know. If you wake up in the morning and you can't quite see the image, your brain will make a fake image rather than not have an image. It's just how our brains work. It wants clarity. It wants to see something. We'll happily see an optical illusion because we'd rather see something than just be staring at a bunch of confusing lines on a page. That's just how brains work. So once we know that, we can kind of distance ourselves from those thoughts. So considering that, let's say 7 billion people on the planet have thoughts about doing the most awful things imaginable at some point in our lives, the fact that it does not happen is pretty important. If 1/7 of the world's population was out there doing these things, we would know about it. In fact, I've never heard of it. Oddly enough, those of us with anxiety never actually do the thing that we worry about. The reason those things click with us is because they're the thing we will absolutely never do. So I hope some people who hear this and who have this, I would say about half the anxious population, usually those with generalized anxiety, have had some experience with it. I have a bunch of family members, and I still find it kind of funny that myself and an aunt of mine have the same one, which I just think is so random that our brains are kind of built that way, had this anxiety, and both came to the same assumption about what we would do someday. And so I've never acted on it. I've never known anyone to act on it. And out of all the millions of Americans, for example, who have this, no one acts on it. Those people who actually do horrible things tend to not have generalized anxiety. Those tend to be very different
issues. And they don't feel guilty and worried about what they might do.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, psychologists deal with this day in and day out. You know, trust me, we're talking hundreds of millions, if not over a billion people who experience this at some point in their life. And I can promise you, we don't act on it. Those who do act on that stuff have other issues. And that was actually a relief for me during my psychological education to kind of go into when people actually act on them. Yeah, it doesn't look anything like what we worry about. It's not based on anxiety. It's based on they're just seeing the world very differently. They literally hear and see things that aren't there and that kind of stuff. And that tends to not be our issue at all. So if you can, know that you're safe. And then when you start to back up from those powerful feelings, I can live with a psychologist saying, don't open that email. To me, I look at it just like a warning light on my dash panel, you know, just something that says, hey, your tire pressure's low. And I go, oh, okay. I don't view it as a literal truth. And for me, 99% of the power comes out of that when I just go, oh, you need to actually work on your anxiety and depression a little bit. That's just all that is for me now. It still comes up once in a great while. And I just go, oh, yeah, you have been slacking a little bit. Time to work on my breathing. Time to up my exercise. Time to get out and be more proactive in my life. And that's all it means to me anymore. So I hope we can get to that point.
It's kind of like a little squirt of just knowing that a little squirt of anxiety chemistry or fight or flight chemistry went into your brain, and it's just looking around for it. And if you know that, you don't really have to feel guilty or anxious about it when you realize what it actually is physically. And this poor boyfriend, she can stop probably haranguing him with all her terrible ideas. It's nice that he's so understanding, too.
That's a good thought. And please know that if you tell him everything, that doesn't make it go away. It can take some of the power out of it a little bit. The important part is that you know what it is, and you know that you'll never act on that stuff, but that's an absolutely normal part of the process. And then you will start working on the anxiety. The bad news, I guess, if it is one, is that if you don't work on the anxiety, say you just spend time with a psychologist and discovering how to not look at that particular thought, or you realize that that thought was silly and it will never happen. If the why question is still there 1,000 times a day, if you're still struggling with that generalized anxiety, it will just wander around and find something else. I've tried that early on in my practice. I've really worked through those issues with people, made them completely convinced that that lump in their throat wasn't cancer or whatever, and it doesn't actually solve the problem. It just tends to move around and pick something else. And I can laugh about it with some of my earlier clients and, you know, talk about, oh, it went from here to there to there, and this is how it works. But when you treat the underlying problem, they tend to naturally lose their power and they kind of disappear on their own. That's the good side.
We are down to about 6 minutes, so if anybody has a question, hit *2 or comment or anything. Otherwise, I'm going to go on to the final question. My anxiety is getting so bad, I think I am going crazy. Does anyone else feel like they are dreaming and that nothing feels real? I get this often, which usually brings on a panic attack, and I feel like I'm going to throw up. All I want to do is just feel normal and be able to live my life.
Yeah. I get only a little bit of this. I get it enough that I know what they're talking about. It's funny, I usually can relate personally to everybody I work with, and this one's kind of a light one. I get this at a low level, but I understand it very well. So if you think about anxiety as part of the fight or flight system, which it is, part of our survival mechanism, and this was a big aha moment for me. I remember when I was going through school, if you listen to people who've survived bear attack, the car ran them over and it was stuck on top of them, you'll get reports of quote-unquote normal people experiencing versions of this. And for the sake of this answer, we'll call it dissociation. The idea that you can look at your own arm and it's really not your arm, and you're really not feeling the normal connection and pain that you would. And it makes perfect sense why this is part of our survival mechanism. If there are times where the right thing to do is to have this kind of dose of anesthesia, as weird as that sounds. And you'll hear these graphic stories of I just cut my own leg off or I ripped it out of the shark's mouth, and it wasn't my leg. I really didn't feel anything. And that is what helps them survive. And so our body has this ability. And of all the aspects of anxiety, this is one of the more well-understood ones. And it's kind of a stroke of luck. The first general anesthesias use this feature. The first general anesthesias are, oddly enough, phencyclidine. These are things that take this effect to its kind of extreme. And so you know phencyclidine better as PCP. Angel dust, it became a bit of a street drug for a while. Why anyone would choose to take this recreationally, I have no idea. But we know that there's a receptor in the brain called the NMDA receptor, and we know if we block it, we can get this effect. If you think about it, it's actually kind of amazing that this brain of ours feels so connected to the body. There's actually a system that does that, and it's one of the more, like I said, well-understood systems. So we can give you a drug. A more modern version of that drug is called ketamine, still used today in surgery and used a lot in animals. It's pretty effective to put an animal quickly asleep, and then they come out very quickly. And animals tend not to freak out like people do. Humans really struggle with this sense of kind of being in their body and not really being in their body. So this is one where we perfectly understand the biomechanics of it. We understand why it's there as part of the fight-or-flight response. So all that being said, that's all it is. You're not actually going to drift out of your body. Yes, it can be a trigger for you for anxiety, but you've got to believe that something actually bad is happening. Through education, if you can step back and go, oh, I know what this is. This is just a symptom of my anxiety. It does not come out of the blue. When anxiety arises, those of us who struggle with this dissociative effect, get a dose of this, and we kind of feel, some people will describe it as like my life is I'm kind of watching a movie. I don't really feel like I'm quite in myself. And that's exactly, I mean, this is incredibly well understood. Freaky, absolutely. And I have clients that struggle with this, and similar to the catastrophic, that kind of super negative thinking we were talking about with the last question, this is, you solve it, same answer. You solve it by treating the generalized anxiety, and this becomes rarer and rarer. But just like you heard me describe why the catastrophic horror thinking that we do comes about, when you understand why this sensation comes about and that it's only a sensation, and you know why it is, where it comes from, what causes it, how it goes away, that it goes away, that it will always go away, then we might be able to avoid that leap we tend to take, which is we say, this is real, this is catastrophic, this is big, life-threatening, soul-threatening. Our brains are incredibly capable of going deep and believing these lies. But it's, again, it's like the former question. These are lies. We learn to know what they are, and we kind of put them to bed. That takes practice. It's hard. I don't mean to talk lightly about it at all, but it's doable. So, yeah, this one's well understood.
Well, some people who just learn about it, then the symptom goes away. And once they're not afraid of it, then the anxiety drifts off. So that's very helpful.
Yeah.
Dissociative
one is a tricky one. Of all the things we face, if you have this, my sympathies, it's fixable. You would go after the anxiety, and it will naturally fade. But of all the scary things I work with people on, that's a tough one. I understand. Feeling like you're kind of drifting out of your body is a pretty disconcerting feeling.
But for me, it also was my body and brain used it when I felt this situation was too tough, and I was able to step away from my physical symptoms. It usually was after a prolonged period of time that I had to wait for whatever thing was coming up, and then finally I would just sort of step aside and zone out, so to speak. It wasn't exactly what they're talking about, but I had the feeling where I didn't care and just move away from the anxiety as a safety feature. You just get to the point where you just can't take any more. It is now 6:00.
Yeah.
I don't know if everybody knows on the call, but I am going into major surgery on the 29th. And after I get out of the hospital, I have to go to a care center for 1 to 2 weeks. And I need to, we have a call on the 7th. I will see if I am in front of a computer or on a telephone. But I'll have to somehow get word to you whether or not we're going to have that call. So maybe if I'm really good and really fast, I'll be able to be home in front of my computer. I'll be in a brace and a walker, but that doesn't bother me as long as I can sit here and see the computer. So,
by the way, when you say major surgery, what are we talking about? Time under the knife?
6 hours this time. He said that they've gotten so fast, they've cut it down by half.
So this used to be a 12-hour surgery, but is now a 6-hour surgery.
Last one was 9 hours. Last one was 9 hours, and this one is going to be 6.
And you're telling me, after all the advice you've heard, that you want to be back on a phone call trying to help others 10 days, 8 days after surgery?
We'll see.
Welcome. I hope this is a lesson for everyone. This is anxious people thinking. We tend to push ourselves so dang hard, and we think that we're the weak ones. We're the non-courageous ones. You have my full permission to push that call off for another couple of weeks.
Well, we'll see. I have lots of things to take care of while I'm gone, which is bothering me because I don't want to let anybody down. So if I let you guys down, I will have my phone. If I feel well enough, last time I didn't feel good enough to have anybody near me for about 8 days. So we'll see. This one, he's telling me he's going to be much better. We'll see, much faster.
Okay.
Well, all right.
If you want. Okay.
Okay, so everybody, have a happy holiday, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, whatever it is for everybody.
Kwanzaa.
Kwanzaa. There's probably more holidays now. And Happy New Year, because it'll be after the New Year that we talk again. So it'll either be the first Thursday or the third Tuesday, and I'm not sure when. But I'll give you a broadcast, and you will know or post it on Facebook. Okay?
Okay.
So good night, everybody.
Good night,
bye.
Everyone. Bye.
The moderator has left the conference.